FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. It's April 10th, 2018. Hey, as always, join the show, join the dialogue, join the discussion. Either leave a message on our hotline, 914-424-4142, or email us at kl@kerrylutz.com. Well, it looks like volatility has replaced risk on, risk off on Wall Street. Looks like we're in for lots more of it. But more importantly, have governments reached the point, U.S., Canada, China, and all the others, where they can no longer inflate prices and prices of assets just have to come down? Well, a resident expert, at least in Canada, is Danielle Park. Danielle, hey, welcome back.
Hey, welcome. Thank you. And I'm in the middle of a snowstorm in April up here again. So all is the same as far as that goes.
Well, you know what's good about that, though? When the housing sales come in low for April, they have a built-in excuse. They just said, well, bad weather in April and March, and the home buyers, you know, they're a very frightful lot, and they just don't like to come out when it's snowing and when the temperature is cold. They need nice weather. It's like retail sales. If it's raining, that's good for retail sales. If it's nice out, that's good for retail sales, but except when it isn't, right?
Absolutely. That's the thing. They always come up with an excuse. It could never be that prices are insane, that debt levels are crushing, that people's income are faltering to keep up with the rise in rates that's happened in the past year. No, it's none of that. It's just about weather.
It's always the weather. You know, because it's the one thing that we really can't do anything about. Although if you read the conspiracy boards, we're doing chemtrails and polluting the atmosphere, trying to change things. I don't quite know what it's doing, if it's doing any good. But that's what the rumor mills on the Internet are implying. But there's no chemtrails going on in the financial markets here. It's very clear for anyone to see if you just take a closer look, right?
Well, you have to really look through the mainstream, you know, marketing machine that proliferates all of the media outlets and that all the experts, so to speak, who are paraded in from the various sales firms to assure everyone that, you know, that a business cycle never ends, that credit can always expand, and that everything is coming up roses.
Yeah, well, I think we're going to go from ABB, always be buying, to ABS, always be selling, probably sooner rather than later.
Well, you know, it's starting to happen in things like the Canadian real estate market. You know, we've been talking about that off and on, and it's been inflating dramatically for the past several years, the past decade in particular. But year over year numbers now are definitely coming in. In some of the hotter areas, north of Toronto, for example, where I live, average sale prices are off about 20%. From this time last year. So it's definitely in process, I think. And, you know, the difficulty is we know the debt levels are extreme. We know that Canada is now being listed as, you know, along with China and Australia and a couple other places, as the most at-risk pockets of population anywhere in the world for over-leverage coming into a housing downturn. So, you know, I know you guys have had some definite appreciation in your housing market in the past 5 years again, but in many areas, you're still not back to where you were at the peak of the 2006-07 cycle. And that's actually pretty typical, right, of a secular burst mean reversion process. A decade later, you're very often not back to where you were. And prices can be stagnant and sideways for a long, long time. And unfortunately, you know, Canada's still got most of that all ahead of us because we've really just begun into the mean reversion process back from this secular expansion in our consumer credit.
Yeah, well, you know, these booms and busts are demographic for sure because, for instance, in in the Northeast here, baby boomers retiring and looking to cut their costs, their cost of living, and you sell and you move down south, whether it's Florida, Tennessee, or Texas, the three states in the South with no income tax, or even some of the other states like South Carolina that have smaller state income taxes. But the cost of living is less than half in these places. So, you know, it can't go on forever, if for no other reason, demographic trends. But then you got the financial cycles, and you really can't fight the cycle, can you?
No. Well, I don't, you know, you shouldn't try. You should try and assess with an objective eye where we are in expansions. Now, the difficulty, I think, in bubble phases is that you can make a rational assessment about where things might be able to get in a particular cycle and then have them go far past that on the upside. But that also then means they go far past that on the correction or downside. So I think, you know, it just takes people to be pragmatists in you know, not believing in fairy tales and just looking at their own balance sheet. I know I say this so much, but it is so essential that you manage things from the balance sheet perspective first. You know, everybody talks about the income statement. Everyone's always, you know, boasting about, you know, what income level they may have at a particular time, either as a business, you know, businesses, their revenue and income expands typically with the credit cycle. Mm-hmm. And they tend to be, you know, boasting about that and not looking at how to put away enough, you know, stored fat for the winter, so to speak. And households do the same thing. You know, they're all about what they can consume and buy and what debt service payments they can make. But they don't appreciate that it just takes, you know, a drop in income or a, you know, an interruption in income or anything like health, marital, you know, just normal run-of-the-mill life stuff can be impossible to absorb. Never mind that's, you know, a rate increase, even a small rate increase when you're highly levered is very difficult. So we're seeing the pistons kind of start to blow across the board, Carrie. We're seeing it through the auto loan mess where, you know, banks have been lending there, you know, in your market. So maybe they haven't as levered on residential real estate this cycle, but they've super levered on to other consumer debt forms, you know, auto loans, debt loans, and they've been securitizing them and selling them to, quote, investments and all that sort of thing. So I think that the contagion effect is going to be, you know, very widespread. And I don't think any particular asset market can be really protected in it from this process because they've borrowed against real estate to buy stocks again, for example. They've borrowed against stocks to buy more stocks. They've borrowed against shares to buy corporate debt. So you really have this, you know, collaborative event where everything went up together, everything was levered together, and then everything mean reverts together. And that, of course, has a very significant or magnified impact on the economy and the tax base. And that's why, you know, it's felt in the form of a deeper recession than you would have had you not had that much debt in the system.
Yeah, well, we never learn from the past. And the only way to end a bust, it seems that the policymakers know, is just to start printing up more money, and then somehow everything's going to take care of itself, right?
Well, you know, no doubt that's the playbook, and that seems to be the only model that the political appetite will tolerate or the central bank academics will tolerate. So we'll see. I'm no doubt if we have the same people, they'll try the same tactics. But, you know, again, not without prices having to come down a great deal. Just because they start buying assets again doesn't mean they'll be able to arrest the process. They didn't arrest the process, you know, in 29. It didn't arrest the process in the last two major downturns. It just perhaps truncates the bottom. But we'll see. We'll see how effective it is the next time around.
Yeah, and seeing softness in these strong markets, they're just a precursor to deeper financial problems. I mean, everything is so much more levered, Danielle. You know, equity seems to be a lost concept here. So
it's really, you know what, Carrie, too? It's the behavioral impact, right? It's the easy money. People have been making easy money by doing reckless things and not really, and thinking that makes them intelligent for doing that. Not managing, as I say, worrying about savings, worrying about paying down debt. A great deal of people have been taking on more and more risk, and they have been rewarded for it. I mean, think of the Bitcoin bubble that we were talking about at the end of last year, you know, when it was above 19,000 and it's now corrected something like 65%. The people that were, you know, proclaiming their own genius back in December are, you know, in many cases wiped out completely or just, you know, gone. Other people who were in the cycle longer have come down with it, and perhaps they didn't have the leverage. They were just holding some money in that. Maybe they will survive through this massive correction. But we should keep in mind that 78 to 80% is actually the run-of-the-mill norm in these kind of environments. It's like you saw after the bubble burst in Japan, realty and stocks. It's what you saw in the 20s, realty and stocks. It's what you're likely to see. It's what we saw in the tech sector after 2000. It's what we saw in venture, the mining and energy and all that sectors after 2006-07. You know, so that sort of 80% decline is pretty normal. So if you don't prepare for that, and it's very difficult to prepare for that if you're fully loaded on risk and leverage, you know, those kind of declines wipe you out in that environment. So it's all about being aware and taking defensive steps before the carnage hits so that you're not selling with the masses.
Hey, and not to tip my hat too much, but I did write an article on December 17th or 18th that Bitcoin was going to crash, that it was a bubble. And, you know, literally a week later, it started crashing. It started its rapid descent because you just know, look, I don't consider myself to be any kind of technical analytical whiz, you know, stock tech technicals, but there's something to it. And when you see something go parabolic or exponential, then the next phase of the parabolic, you know, waveform is to go down substantially. But the beauty of Bitcoin, though, is because it's a lightly traded market. What, at the peak, Daniel, there were only less than 500,000 transactions per day. Now there's less than 200,000 Bitcoin transactions per day. All you need is some kind of crazy rumor or some kind of disruption on a market someplace. A big bank gets into trouble, hits the skids. You can just think of the scenarios, the so-called black swans, the known knowns and the known unknowns, and then the unknown unknowns, which who the heck knows, we get hit by an asteroid, but, you know, absurd. But the point is that the Bitcoin and the cryptocurrencies will keep going through this for years, up and down like this. I don't believe by any stretch that it's done, that the mania is finished, because it's a like a half-eaten steak, if you will, you know?
Well, you know, it's like driving a car. If you drive your car, you put on your seatbelt, you have sort of safety features in the car. Why do you do all that? Because you know that in your life or, you know, in certain circumstances, the prospects of getting in an accident are actually pretty high. You know, and so you take precautions at all times, not just when you, you know, not just here and there, but you try and take those precautions every time you go out driving to, you know, not go as fast as the vehicle can go, but to monitor your pace and all those things. Why do you do that? It's called risk management, right? So the same thing has to apply to financial decisions. And unfortunately, people just lose their mind and start, you know, driving like maniacs on black ice with no safety precautions, and they assume that that's going to work out. And of course, it doesn't. And then, you know, they're devastated, and it's too bad because it was completely foreseeable. So you got lucky in writing your article 2 weeks before it crashed, because, you know, none of us know exactly when these crashes happen. All we do know is that the propensity for it to happen is either high or low in a given set of circumstances. And the greatest risk, of course, being price and valuation and leverage. Those things are like a, you know, prescription for how these problems unfold. So it, because they're predictable, because it's not meteorites hitting from outer space, completely predictable, it is completely possible to, you know, manage your behavior around it and to be prepared to take advantage of it and to protect yourself from it. It is possible, but you have to be a thoughtful person. You have to develop the discipline and rules. You have to, you know, not succumb to the madness of crowds.
Yeah, it's really what it's about. And yeah, I would say, I wouldn't say I was lucky there. That whole thing, it could have happened 3 months later, but it was just so obviously heading towards a bust. And then when I saw the articles in the Times, New York Times, and other financial publications start to turn against it and talk about manipulation in cryptocurrencies, pump and dumps, and all that, then I knew it was time. It just had to be. And sure enough, and it's not going to be the last time it happens, though, because nobody has learned anything from, or they've learned the wrong lessons from that crash. That's the problem, Danielle. People learn the wrong lessons from crashes rather than the right lessons, right? I mean, isn't that what happens?
I don't know. I've seen all sorts. I've seen some people who learn zero. I've seen some people who change their behavior entirely and are better for it. It's an incredibly strengthening, fortifying experience to go through a financial crisis, because if you can do it early on, it can really transform your understanding and behavior and set you up for strength for many, many years thereafter. And then other people just repeat, you know, the same thing over and over. So I think, again, it's all about the individual. You know, there's blanket statements you can say, people never change. Actually, I know lots of people that change, but it is always on a case-by-case basis. Absolutely.
Yep, very true. And hey, with all the bubbles that are being inflated or starting to pop now, this could, when one pops, conceivably they could all pop, right?
Well, this is it. I think that, like I said, the interconnection this time is, you know, this is the high beta rich book that Robert Frank wrote in 2007-08 about the interconnection of asset bubbles and revenues and service industries that are focused on these asset heavy in sectors, and how governments get the, you know, too much of the revenue in these periods from those same sectors, and how when they all burst, revenues plunge, the tax base is, you know, wiped out, and it's just, it's because we have to get off this idea that everything can go up at the same time, including insatiable amounts of spending on debt, you know, and so long as we keep trying to repeat that model, we'll absolutely have to have everything rise and fall together and suffer those consequences.
Yeah, so what's an investor to do now? I mean, obviously take profits if you have them, but what else do you do as an investor?
You really need to calibrate yourself to be the opposite of the masses right now. So the masses, we know, are fully extended, tons of debt, tons of exposure to high valuations in real estate. We know that the retail crowd came into equities in volume in the last year. They've been selling again a bit year to date, but it was always, you know, they're always late cycle. So you need to be early cycle. You need to, you know, have taken your profits before the mania really peaks. You have to have the tolerance to sit out and just watch it kind of continue. And then you have to have, you know, as I say, focus on the balance sheet. Everyone's talking about their income and how much, you know, they're able to buy on credit. So you need to be the opposite and focus on how to pay off your debt, build up your cash, and have low leverage in periods of high risk, so that you are able to take strategic investment opportunity when everything is on sale. You need to be the buyer in a buyer's market and a seller in a seller's market instead of the other way around.
Yeah. Hey, great point. Well, anyway, if you haven't read it yet, go over to Danielle's site, jugglingdynamite.com, must reading to get a dose of sanity in an otherwise insane world where financial markets have run amok and continue to run amok. And hey, feel free to send us an email, kl@carrielutz.com, Twitter feed @CarrieLutz, Facebook page, Financial Survival Network. Danielle, we'll talk to you in a couple weeks.
Thanks, Carrie.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.